Welcome to the Radical Imagination Podcast, where we dive into the stories and solutions that are fueling change. I'm your host, Angela Glover Blackwell, and this is the final episode of our first season.
Shots being fired, and there are people running, possibly victims involved.
I think we got shots fired. Possible shots fired.
Again, we have a report of subject with a gun.
The radical idea we're going to look at today addresses a big problem in the U.S. especially, gun violence. Every year, more than 100,000 people are shot in the U.S. And the reality is that gun-related homicides often happen in low-income communities of color. City authorities will typically respond by hiring more police officers, increasing neighborhood patrolling, and then just hoping for the best. But what if we tried a different path? For example, police abolition, a topic we tackled in a previous episode, where people are trying to reduce the role of police in certain neighborhoods and test out less harmful alternatives. Take Richmond, California, a city that has struggled with rampant gun violence since the 1930s.
Richmond police say this isn't a random shooting. However, they do not believe the victim was the intended target.
It's also the place where an organization named Advance Peace has come up with a new approach to disrupt gun-related homicides. It does this by hiring young men with a history of lethal weapon offenses, taking them from being a part of the problem to the forefront of finding solutions. And we'll be hearing a riveting personal story from one of those young men later in this episode. But before that conversation, we're first joined by Devone Bogan. He's the founder and CEO of Advance Peace, and he's here to tell us why he thinks that betting on these young men who have been written off by society is the right approach. And full disclaimer, I'm on the board of Advance Peace, and I've known Devone for several years. Devone, welcome to Radical Imagination.
I'm excited to be here.
Would you start by telling people what Advance Peace is and how it started in Richmond, California?
Advance Peace reduces cyclical and retaliatory gun violence in U.S. urban neighborhoods by engaging the individuals who are at the center of gun violence. So Advance Peace addresses violent actors that traditional law enforcement has struggled to address. So that's the first thing. So my job, without a gun, without a badge, was to help the city address what seemed to be a very intractable problem, a historic challenge.
It is the fourth homicide in Richmond in just 3 weeks after a peaceful start to the year.
35, 40 homicides a year. 30 years. So I think it's important that we lift up the city of Richmond because it was the public system leadership who said, we've got to do something very different. We've put more police on the streets, and that's not helping us to get to where we want to get to. So we need another instrument. I think the second was this idea of capturing formerly incarcerated individuals who themselves had a common lived experience with those who were at the center of that city's gun violence epidemic.
Five bullets came from a white Mazda.
A brother and sister shot to death in Richmond last night.
This potent mix of pain, anger, and teenagers with guns. Here, the streets are hunting grounds. Corner after corner, young men run for their lives.
So we decided to hire formerly incarcerated individuals from the city of Richmond as city government employees, full-time, fully vested. Not only were we looking for formerly incarcerated individuals from the city of Richmond, but we were looking for formerly incarcerated individuals who had gun charges in their backgrounds to become what we call neighborhood change agents, to be deployed in those neighborhoods where gun violence was most prevalent, to begin to engage those individuals who were thought to be most responsible for that gun violence. So that's the second thing that we were able to accomplish. And then the third thing, we would only focus on those individuals who law enforcement had the greatest difficulty addressing, individuals who were suspected to be actively involved in gun violence, who had yet to face a legal or criminal consequence for those acts of gun violence. So our thesis was and is, unless and until law enforcement can stop those who shoot from shooting, those same individuals should be motivated, they should be inspired, they should be empowered to change their behaviors on their own.
in exchange for turning away from dangerous behavior. The men, about 40 of them right now, aged 16 to 25, join the fellowship. They draw up a life map where they set positive goals for the future. They get daily contact and counseling, help finding jobs and money. Bogan says the funding comes from private donors. Over an 18-month period, that money becomes an incentive for the men to choose better behavior. Mess up, and they will get nothing.
Wow. I mean, first, we're talking about neighborhood safety. Then we're talking about people formerly incarcerated with guns being neighborhood change agents, and then focusing on people who are engaged in gun violence on the street, but not yet in the system. And this is not about police going out and doing anything.
That's correct. And what most folks don't know or recognize, Angela, is that in urban communities where gun violence is most prevalent, the prosecution rates are oftentimes less than 30%. So, for example, take Chicago, which everyone likes to talk about. By the way, it's not the most dangerous city in the country. But everyone talks about Chicago. It's had 1,400 murders by firearm over the last 2 years. Less than 25% of the individuals suspected of those acts of gun violence will ever see a day of time for those suspected acts. So we know that law enforcement and incarceration isn't working. So why not try something different that keeps these individuals from crossing that line again?
So tell us about the results in Richmond.
In Richmond, we had 84 fellows through four 18-month fellowship cohorts. 84 individuals who were thought to be the most lethal young men in the city of Richmond, who were also thought to be those most likely to become victims of gunfire. And that's another piece I'd like to lift up. So of those 84 fellows today, 94% of them are alive. And I love when I hear alumnus of our fellowship say, hang out with the Office of Neighborhood Safety or Advanced Peace, and you're going to stay alive. Now, they use very different language when they describe it. It's probably not appropriate for this podcast. But 83% of these individuals who were thought to be dead within a six-month period of us beginning our fellowship engagement with them have not been injured by a firearm today. And here's the biggest, smallest number of 77% of our fellows since becoming a fellow are not thought to be in new firearm-related activity. That has translated into a 72% reduction in firearm activity in the city of Richmond that has now been sustained for 5 years. And the greater impact is how those fellows that are alive are now providing a healthier model for folks who have great close proximity to them in those very communities. Because we didn't move them out. They still live in the city of Richmond.
This is so inspiring to hear what you've done and especially to hear the results that are associated with it. I want you to pull back for a moment. You have shown that we can make a difference without police. What are the implications for policing?
It's a great question, Angela. The idea of the concept of public safety being expanded beyond policing and incarceration to include these kinds of interventions and community empowerment is a heavy lift and a work in progress. I think I would be remiss not to be honest with you here today and with your audience to tell you that one of our greatest critics when we show up in a city is the policing unions in those cities. That's going to be very challenging for law enforcement because at some point we've got to begin to think about how we retrain and redirect those resources, and that's frightening for folks in that law enforcement space. I have seen how these young men and the issues that they are participating in that creates disruption and destruction are used to raise large amounts of resources. You look at any municipal budget of a city who's struggling with gun violence issues, and I guarantee you, you're going to find that 50, 60% of that budget is public safety. Most governments would have said, oh, no, oh, heck no. can't bring these guys into city government. In fact, law enforcement had a huge challenge with the folks I decided, because these were folks that, for a veteran police officer, he or she had chased these guys in their heyday. So they were really challenged by it. But we were able to convince them that these guys themselves had their own transformational process and could demonstrate that they could work successfully.
And Devone, that has been part of the criticism that people have leveled at you.
Advanced Peace takes violent criminals, violent alleged criminals, and offers them 365-day-a-year counseling, job training, mentoring, and one other thing.
Criminals are paid not to commit crime. I'm serious.
Understandably, some on the right...
What people accuse you of doing is paying people not to shoot.
Yeah.
Paying people not to shoot. How do you respond to that?
I tell you what, when you think about the cost of gun violence on a city, for every homicide, a conservative cost is $1 million. And a further conservative cost is about $400,000. Mother Jones Magazine did an expose in July 2015, I believe, on the cost of gun violence. And they said that we had spent $229 billion chasing gun violence in the year 2012. That was the last year the CDC did a study on the cost of gun violence. And that comes out to be about $400,000 every time someone is shot. So when you consider the cost every time someone is shot, and then you hear the criticism of paying criminals, albeit that's not what we do, but if $9,000 over an 18-month period kept people who shoot from shooting, I think it's a phenomenal investment, right? That's my response. The second response I have, what we're doing is much deeper. We often talk about getting these guys jobs or connecting these guys to services. Well, understand, the jobs are not ready for these guys. And these guys aren't ready for the jobs. And that goes for the social and human services aspects of things, too. Even where services are available and abundant, more often than not, they are not ready for this population. By the way, I don't talk about this a lot, but my family is a victim of gun violence. 8 months after I took the job in the city of Richmond, I lost my youngest brother to gunfire in the city of Lansing, Michigan. And when I went home to bury my brother, I came back really thinking that, you know what, maybe this isn't for me. I mean, it was a blow. I didn't see that coming. And it was a fellow, someone that I had hired at our office to help me understand gun violence, someone who was directly involved in it, who said to me, "Welcome to my world, and I don't get to leave." That has always stuck with me. So I think being able to never forget whose voice you're carrying, whose message you're carrying, and making sure that's genuine, authentic, and real at all times, at all cost.
One of the things that you really bring to this work is seeing people in their wholeness. Talk about that.
As I look at these young men and see myself, see my brothers, see my team, these young men are us, and they want what we want. They want safety. They want security. They want to make a contribution. They just haven't had anyone to provide them with a model or even the support of what a healthy contribution looks like. They want to be loved. They want to be cared for. They want to be embraced. They want everything that we want. I think going in, I knew, but it became crystal clear as I work with these young men every single day. And they were committed. They were committed to trying something different in spite of them continually negotiating a barrage of warlike environments that they were having to navigate and negotiate.
Devone, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Devone Bogan is the founder and CEO of Advanced Peace and a former neighborhood safety director with the city of Richmond, California. Coming up on Radical Imagination, we speak with James Houston. He was 16 years old when he was convicted of second-degree murder. After 18 years in prison, he is now a neighborhood change agent and a senior advisor to Advanced Peace. Stay with us. More when we come back.
Are you someone who wants to create a society where all can participate and prosper? Visit our website at radicalimagination.us to take action and connect with campaigns and organizations around issues covered by this podcast. It's crucial that we get support to continue to lift up stories and solutions to address our most pressing problems. To do this, we need you to tell your friends and family about Radical Imagination. Ask them to subscribe, share, and comment on their chosen podcast platform. You can also find us on the Race and Wealth Podcast Network. Like what you've heard today? Tell us about it. Go to Apple Podcasts to rate and review Radical Imagination. And thank you.
And we're back. James Houston was convicted of second-degree murder at 21 after intervening in a domestic dispute that ended up with him shooting and killing a man. He served 18 years in prison, and he is now lead neighborhood change agent for the City of Richmond's Office of Neighborhood Safety. James, welcome to Radical Imagination.
Thank you, Angela.
I am curious what it was like for you growing up. What are some of your clearest memories of that?
Actually, I was born in Decatur, Illinois. My mother and father were together at that time. At 6 years old, I seen my mother being abused by my father. And I remember my brother, who was 5 years old, he was the one who went up to my father and bit him on a leg. My father picked him up and threw him over a table onto a couch. And for me, that fight, flight, or freeze, I froze. And from that moment on, I kind of felt like a coward. Shortly after that, my mother picked us up and moved us to California. And I felt that I had something to prove. Like, I was the oldest. I had to make a name for our family out there because of what was going on in the streets in Richmond.
What was going on the streets of Richmond?
There was a lot of fights, a lot of drugs. I remember imitating the drug dealers. They never taught me how, but I watched from a distance. And I felt like as the oldest, it was my responsibility to kind of contribute to the family.
When you were growing up in Richmond, looking at who was on the streets and who seemed to have status on the streets, did you have anybody to turn to talk to bounce ideas off of as you were developing yourself?
I had one person, and it was my great uncle. I didn't appreciate him at that point. I felt that he was in his, I would say, about 50s. And so I felt like he couldn't relate. But he did a lot to try to bring me under his wing. He started me off at 8 years old in Pop Warner football. When I started working summer jobs, he would give me a ride, field trips for school. He was the one who made the lunches for us. But I never seen him as somebody I could look up to because I felt like he didn't understand.
You were 21 years old in 1996, is that right? And that's when the incident happened that suddenly changed your life. Could you walk us through that?
I was in the streets selling drugs. I had been shot at before. I was carrying a gun. I had no conflict resolution skills. I was an angry young man. I was frustrated because I had a son who was 10 months. I didn't know how to be a father. All I knew at the time was money, get more money. I didn't know the power of being there in his life and the impact that was and how more important that was. So I'm coming home from the store. I started drinking a lot more. I seen my neighbor, who was a friend of mine's mother, in a conflict with her boyfriend, who I also knew and I had actually sold drugs to. They called me over there because they knew the type of person I was. I went over there, I confronted him, I said, give her money back. He said, no. I pulled out my gun to kind of intimidate him with the gun. He reached for it, I pulled back and shot him.
You had the gun.
Yes, I did.
Why did you have a gun?
For me, protection and also, with that gun, I felt powerful. I felt like somebody that you was going to listen to.
And when you say they knew the kind of guy you were, what are you talking about when you say that?
Even though I did a lot of negative things in the community, in my way, I felt like I was the type of person that would look out for you if you needed me in a violent situation. even talking to my family, most of the things that I was there for them for was violent situations. I had never let go of that feeling of being a coward. I was always constantly trying to make up for that moment. And so when that situation came with my neighbor, I had to realize, you know, because when I first committed the crime, I never thought that I would get that much time, an 18-to-life sentence. I felt like I should be rewarded, like I did something good. And over time, as I looked at it and got to know myself and know my own story, because I had ran from it so long, I realized that it wasn't about conflict going on, neither one of them. It was about that little boy at 6 years old trying to prove that he wasn't a coward.
What was life like in prison? What did you reflect on when you were there, and how did that experience change you?
When I first started my prison sentence, I would say approximately the first 7 years, I was pretty much the same guy I was on the streets. I was incarcerated in Susanville, and there was no programs. And so all I did was hang on the yard and pretty much continue the same things that I did when I was on the streets. Fortunately, I was transferred to San Quentin State Prison, where there were a plethora of programs for me to participate in. And it was the first time I ever had another man see me in my potential. I remember I was working on death row, sweeping. I wanted to go, you know, work in education, go to school, go to college. And the hours conflicted. And I talked to someone who became a friend, and he talked to some people and got me shifted from that job to another job where I can go to take college courses. I never had a man really give me something and not want nothing in return. You know, usually selling drugs, it was trying to work you to get, you know, some extra drugs or some free drugs. But for someone who just genuinely wanted to see the best in you, it sparked something in me. And so I started following these men and seeing, are you real? Is this really you? And it turned out they were.
So what was it like on that day when you got out?
It was a great day. Once again, my uncle still was there. He had bought me a suit to come home in. I got out early enough to go pick my son up from school because he never knew me on this side of the wall. And just being reunited with family. And I guess the scary part for me was that the prison time just seemed like it was an overnight dream. That time hadn't really happened.
What was the hardest part about being back in community and society?
For me, I think the hardest part was understanding that I was 40 years old and hadn't, you know, built up anything financially for my future and wanting things for my son that at that point, you know, this was his last year of high school. And there was a lot of things I wish I could do, but I couldn't.
And so how did you connect with Advanced Peace?
Actually, I connected with Advanced Peace in prison. I was incarcerated. I was the chairman of a group called the Richmond Project, where we was trying to make a difference from inside. And Devon, one day he popped up in my cell and we had a conversation. He started coming to our meetings. And at some point, I remember him saying that if you ever get out, because I was still had a life sentence at the time and I'm doing something in Richmond, you got a job.
You've written about how important it is to relate to young men who have turned to guns, that they feel isolated, frustrated, searching for purpose. Could you describe more about your own reflections and how that's helped you to be able to work with other people who are following that path that you had been on?
For me, it's if you feel so great about yourself or know your worth, why would you involve yourself in some of the things many of our young men involve themselves in? Nobody has invested in them, so they feel like nothing. And many of them are doing the same thing I did, crying out in their own way for attention. As a young man, I can't come to you in the neighborhood and say, I'm hurting. The shame. Me, I don't have shame. I have guilt for what I've done, but I use that guilt to motivate me to work with these young men.
So what does it mean to be a neighborhood change agent? Walk me through what you do day to day and what kind of activities you're involved in.
So day to day, we have our meetings, but each day we go out to the neighborhood, building those relationships, sharing our stories. We can see when they're going through something, when something's bothering them, because it's not just the superficial type engagement.
Tell us about the kind of situation you might deal with. What sorts of things come up, and how are you able to guide or intervene or help these young men see a different way?
Well, it depends on the different types of conflicts. So some conflicts may be internal, and those are usually easier to navigate. So if a young man is having a problem with another young man from his own community, we kind of like share our experiences. What I've learned over time is I don't care who you with. I tell them, if I would have been in that cell doing time with my mother, we'd have conflict. And it's okay to have conflict. It's just all about how you deal with it. External conflict, we usually rely on some of our relationships with the young people. Say I have a young man that I'm more close to, and we see that there's something arising with another man who's from a different side of town. It may be me to go talk to the one that I'm had a better relationship with, and then another change agent will go talk to the other young man. And we talk about, you know, try to see where it started from. At some point, try to bring them together, if not a phone call, and then bring them together.
And how is that going? How are your conversations going with these young men? Do you find that once they open up that you really are able to go into some different directions in terms of conversation and action?
I definitely feel that it helps a lot because as a young man, you feel like nobody else's story is as bad as mine. Nobody's been through what I've been through. And for somebody to share and relate and you be able to say, that was me. I felt that. I've been through that. But we don't talk about that. We only are healthy as our worst secrets because we're stuck in our shame. I'm wrong. Not that something happened to me that was wrong, that shouldn't have happened. And it's lessons and gifts even in that. But we choose to hold because we feel like that's not the manly thing to do.
What do you see needs to happen in this country to change the prevalence of gun violence? And what are you learning from your activities that reinforces your beliefs?
We have to change our view of our young people. We have to stop seeing them where they are now and seeing their potential and making those investments in their future. Because a lot of what's created in these communities has been going on for a long time. These young people stepped into a lot of these conflicts. They weren't the ones who started it. And so once we really invest in seeing that we play a part in what a lot of our young people are experiencing, I think we will better be equipped to address and resolve a lot of the conflict. But it can't be just a conflict arises, let's throw more police at the conflict or the problem.
What I hear you saying is that society's inability to see the potential in these young people hides the potential from them. They can't see it.
Exactly.
And that we both have to start seeing it and reacting to it and treating these young people as the jewels that they are.
They are. We stop looking at them a certain way where they feel like I'm not wanted, then their view of themselves will change as well. I feel like I'm one of the young people. I feel like all that I've been through, now it has some type of value. I feel like it's a way to honor, you know, my victims. It's what I was meant to do. I hate the crime that I committed to get me to this place, but I'm grateful that I'm able to do this work.
James, I'm grateful that you're doing the work, and I pick up talking to you that there's real power and strength that you have found that you're putting out. I think of it as a superpower. What's your superpower?
If I would name a superpower, I would say my passion. Because I know in this work, dealing with young people, they know when somebody genuinely cares. You can't fake it with them. You have to really be from the heart. They see through you.
James, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you, Angela.
James Houston is a lead neighborhood change agent for the City of Richmond's Office of Neighborhood Safety. He is also a senior advisor to Advance Peace. Solving the problems of police violence and mass incarceration can seem overwhelming, but visionary solutions are bubbling up across the country. Advance Peace shows what's possible when communities stop relying on the tools and hostile assumptions of law enforcement and focus instead on the outcomes we want to achieve. Peace, safety, healing, communities where everyone is valued and treated with respect and where all people, especially youth, have opportunities to make positive contributions. Reflecting on Devone Bogan's work, I'm struck by how often and unjustly young people of color are held up as the problem when it comes to community safety. Bogan shatters that destructive narrative. In fact, youth are our greatest asset and the key to building humane, dignified, and effective systems for public safety and justice. James Houston is an example of what we throw away when we assume that some people are dispensable. And seeing the contribution that he can make by giving back to his community in terms of helping other young people turn their lives around. Everybody has a contribution to make. Radical Imagination was produced by Futuro Studios for PolicyLink. The Futuro Studios team includes Marlon Bishop, Andreas Caballero, Ruxandra Guidi, Stephanie LeBeau, and Jeannie Montalvo. The PolicyLink team includes Rachel Gashinga, Glenda Johnson, Fran Smith, Jacob Gulkasian, and Millie Hawk Daniel. Our theme music was composed by Taka Yusasawa and Alex Zagura. I'm your host, Angela Glover Blackwell. This is the last episode of our first season, but please be on the lookout for more episodes in the next season of Radical Imagination. And in the meantime, you can find us online at radicalimagination.us. Remember to subscribe and share.